Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, members of the Jesuit Order prepare for their general congregation. Coming up next week, we'll be talking with Superior General Father Peter Hans Kolvenbach, who will be stepping down to make way for a new Superior General. And looking ahead to the Feast of the Epiphany, one of the most colorful events of the Nativity is captured in art from the very earliest Christian times to the present. But how do three kings turn into a witch on this day? Jesuits will be holding their 35th General Congregation from Monday the 7th. The religious order, one of the Catholic Church's biggest, was founded by St. Ignatius of Loyola in the early 1500s. Some 225 Jesuits from provinces all over the world will be electing a new Superior General. They are expected to elect the successor to Dutch Father Peter Hans Kolvenbach. Father Kolvenbach is stepping down after almost a quarter century at the helm of the order, also known as the Society of Jesus. While the Jesuits today number close to 20,000 religious, but their ranks have suffered from the general decline in vocations in the Church in recent decades. Just 40 years ago, the order counted 36,000 members. Father Kolvenbach spoke to Vatican Radio ahead of the congregation. He says the order, which focuses on mission, social justice, and peace, has been particularly involved in promoting the balance between faith and reason that Pope Benedict has so often spoken about.
Jesuits have a privileged position from which they can study this relationship. Our many universities throughout the world, which, of course, must consider dialogue between faith and reason. Once, the sciences of theology and philosophy were considered to be intimately connected to the range of human values. Now, positive sciences are taking possession of the transmission of the meaning and values of human life. Without placing obstacles in the paths of science, a Christian university is called to seek truth in its totality and therefore also consider the alliance between science and Christian faith. As Blaise Pascal said once, in man there is something that infinitely supersedes man. In other words, in order to give meaning to human life, one cannot ignore the transcendence of faith. We receive light and a certain understanding of this mystery, which inevitably surrounds our entire existence from Christ's gospel. Between mystery and absurdity, we opt for mystery. A mystery cannot be proved by reason, but it is eminently reasonable. Indeed, John Paul II never accepted the principle of division and separation of revelation and reason. In the intellectual commitment which must characterize a Christian university in the 21st century, the Jesuits want to follow the path outlined by Pope Benedict, the study of a faith which illuminates and crowns reason's endeavors.
Because they are present in communities all over the world, the Jesuits have also been actively involved in interfaith dialogue. Father Kolvenbach shares with us some insight.
If dialogue is to be possible, then it must go beyond mere courtesy and be carried out with sincere mutual respect. Without this, there is no dialogue. At most, there is confrontation. John Paul II indicated another path when he spoke of a dialogue of life that consists of sharing those same desires and concerns that are found in every community. The desire to live in peace for security in a pollution-free environment or desires. In this atmosphere of shared goals and solution-seeking, then a second step may take place, a religious dialogue, an exchange of spiritual and religious experiences in which genuine religious sentiments are found despite the obvious differences. Finally, there is religious dialogue rooted in theological elements drawn from both religions. Naturally, this is reserved for theologians, who should, with all respects, stop and dwell upon one insoluble problem. The faith of Christians in the Holy Trinity cannot be reduced to pure monotheism, such as that professed by Islam. This last theological difficulty should not, however, prevent progress in the dialogue of life recommended by the Pope, because both Christians and Muslims have a truly religious sense of life and share the belief that man does not live by bread alone.
Father Peter Hans Kolvenbeck, outgoing Superior General of the Jesuit Order. Well, the new Superior General to be elected in the coming meetings will be received together with members of the congregation by Pope Benedict on February 21st here in the Vatican. Meanwhile, Father Thomas Rashford, who is Secretary of Communications for the Society of Jesus, sat down with Emer McCarthy. He said the order held its last congregation back in 1994.
This will be the 35th general congregation in almost 500 years of the Society's existence. So it's not something that happens very often. And the big difference is that a congregation, the primary reason for having one is to elect a new superior general, and he's elected for life. And now some, like Father Kolvenbeck, has been in office for 24 years already. The longest man was almost 30 years. But the superior general is responsible for works all over the world. So he has to get to know, there's still close to 18,000, 19,000 Jesuits. And even though our numbers are going down, the number of works we run keeps going up.
The Jesuits call the general congregation not on a regular basis like other orders. The last general congregation, as you pointed out, was 1994. So that was, almost 14 years ago at this point. Why are there such great distances, such great periods of time between one congregation and the other? Do you need less organization than other orders, or what is the difference?
Just in terms of the facts, so of the 35 general congregations, 28 of them were called to elect a new general superior. So in times past, that usually meant the man had died, although the last three superior generals had all ended their life in poor health. So you get to the term of what somebody is able to do. So the main reason for calling a general election is to elect a new superior general. But the superior general's role is not something that changes very frequently. It takes a while because he has to know people all over the world. 6 years wouldn't be enough time to get to know everybody. 12 years isn't really that much time. But a lot depends on your health. Now, Father Kolvenbeck has had very good health, and so he's been able to stay at this a long time, but he's almost 80.
Looking at the fact that the Society of Jesus is a global society, you have Jesuits from all corners of the world. I'm struck by the fact that we have a low number in, for example, Eastern Europe. Well, that's obvious for obvious reasons. Communism was in power there for such a long time. But I am struck by the fact that we have such a large number of Jesuits in East Asia and Oceania.
Well, it's not actually in both East Asia and South Asia. What's interesting there is that the number of Catholics in the population is relatively low, but the number of Jesuits is relatively high. Those are both younger countries. And in general, for many religious orders, there are many more vocations in the Southern Hemisphere. So the Northern Hemisphere, Europe, and to a lesser extent the U.S., would tend to be older, whereas the other side is growing. And there's a lot, I mean, there's a billion and a half people in India. So even if the percentage of Catholics is low, the total number is not that low. And so they have a lot of vocations there. East Asia is a little bit less, but like Indonesia is one of our bigger provinces.
Indonesia?
Yeah, which is a majority Muslim country, but it does have a strong Catholic population, and it's had very strong vocations. It does work, and the church is very alive and very bright, very vibrant. Africa has a lot of vocations as well. What you find in like, for example, in Africa is that there are a lot of younger Jesuits. So they have a lot of really good men, but they're just coming into their own, taking the positions of leadership. So, for example, some of the African delegates who are coming are provincials who just finished doctorates, for example, and were kind of sent into administration and leadership roles very, very early on. Mm-hmm. So the society is still very much, it's very, very much alive. There are a lot of younger men. I think the median age of the delegates is somewhere in their early 50s. So it's not an early thing. At one point, the tradition was that it was the oldest men who would be voted to go to the congregation. But that's certainly not true. So now, like I say, so the delegates, by and large, there are a few, three or four, that are 70 or more. But the greatest number are in their 50s, some are in their 40s.
Father Thomas Rashford is Secretary of Communications for the Society of Jesus. It is one of the landmark events in almost every nativity story, the three wise men, or three kings, who come bearing gifts and to pay homage to the newborn Christ child. Celebrated every January 6th by the Catholic Church, the Feast of the Epiphany marks the moment when the three travelers reach their destination, the humble stable in Bethlehem, the place Mary, Joseph, and the child Jesus have made their temporary home.
Epiphany means the manifestation. So from that first birth of Christ in a stable with an ox, an ass, and a couple of shepherds, we go to the arrival of the outside world that comes to pay homage to Christ. And so in the moment of the Epiphany, we realize that Jesus has come for everybody. It's the great expression of the self-revelation of God on a universal level.
Christian art historian Elizabeth Lev says the Feast of the Epiphany has been of incredible importance to the history of art, but even more so to the very history of humanity. She explains that some of the very first images of the Epiphany are contained in the Christian catacombs here in Rome. It was in these underground chambers in the first 3 centuries after Christ's death that the first Christians, persecuted for their beliefs, practiced their faith in secret and buried their dead.
The catacombs of St. Priscilla contain 2nd century, at the latest early 3rd century, images of the three wise men, among other very, very limited number of scenes, but one of them is the three wise men. Most of the other scenes are from the Old Testament. The importance of the Epiphany is such that in some Christological cycles, the image of the Epiphany can take the place of everything. What I mean is, instead of having to show all these different images of the life of Christ, it is enough in a catacomb chapel to put the Epiphany, because all you need to know is God came into the world to show himself to you.
Who were the three kings who went to Bethlehem?
Well, the three kings undergo tremendous interpretation, reinterpretation, and reinterpretation during the course of the centuries. As a matter of fact, they are magi, which is interpreted by us today as wise men. In the Middle Ages, the idea of kingship, and so we call them the three kings. But the word magi is the word magician. These are men who are capable of great prodigies. These are men who are already very wise. They have a connection to things that are not easily accessible to people of this world. So they're seen as something that already have a contact and understanding with the invisible and, by extension, the divine. And that these three men, who are all pagan, recognize that there is this divine moment in act. The divine is coming into the world, and they travel from far, far, far away to bring homage to that divinity, shows this recognition of the foreign, the external, of the coming of Christ.
We commonly know the three wise men as Melchior, Gaspar, and Baldassare, coming from Europe, Asia, and Africa.
The scriptures give us a very bare-bones account of these three magi, these three wise men who came from afar and who brought gifts. And from there, the three men, the gifts, the gifts are a fulfillment of scriptural writing of Isaiah, but the
gold, frankincense,
and myrrh. The wise men, their provenance, their day jobs, they have been interpreted and reinterpreted, and that is the essence of the story, because the point of the story is the universality of Christ. And so if we could fit those three men into cages and say that these are the people that Jesus came for, then it would miss the point of being that Jesus came for everyone. So you will see images of the three wise men as old, middle-aged, and young. You'll see the three wise men as black, white, and Asian. They will be everything to everybody, because the point is that Jesus came for everyone. The names are given to the Magi in the Middle Ages. The placement is given to the Magi almost immediately. The image of Priscilla, the image of the catacombs of Priscilla, shows the Magi, at least as we can distinguish today, we can't tell their faces apart. We can't really tell the gifts apart. The only thing we see is that one is green, one is white, and one is red. And so at this point, we see them as representing geographic space. They wear these funny hats that are indicative of foreigners. For an ancient Roman, they would recognize the hat as someone who was not Roman. It was a freedman's hat. And so here you have these three different colors, three different continents, three different parts of the known world that are not Rome, coming to pay homage to this king, to this child, to God. Later on in the Magi cycle, the Magi will also represent, and to me this is one of the more interesting aspects, the sense of magician. They represent three different philosophical systems that the Christianity, the self-revelation of God, puts to rest or supersedes, if you will. And so one of the wise men would be represented as the Eastern tradition of Zoroaster, and this sort of very complex, exotic religions of the East and these philosophical systems that render their homage that Christ supersedes them. The second thinking system, of course, would be the great Greek system, descended from Plato, the Hellenistic tradition of thought. And again, they bear gifts and they render homage to the truth that is greater than theirs. And then finally, the last of the Magi would be Daniel, and would represent the Old Testament, recognizing the arrival of the fulfillment of the scriptures in Jesus.
The The theme of the Epiphany has been widely depicted in art throughout the centuries, even to the present day. From the earliest simple images in the catacombs, the Magi were later portrayed in elaborate costumes, exotic, colorful robes, accompanied sometimes by entire caravans of camels and elephants and porters. And they are almost always found in the nativity scenes Christians set up to remember Christ's birth at Christmas time.
The Magi are everywhere. In the early years, you'll see them transform from a hastily painted fresco on a catacomb wall to the carved sarcophagi. If you were to ever go to some place like the Pio Christian Museum of the Vatican Museums, you would see walls, entire walls, representing the scene of the Epiphany, because it was so important to the 4th century, 5th century people who insisted on having this image on their coffins. Then one of the most colorful, one of the most fun, interesting images of the Magi is in Santa Maria Maggiore, and you have to look a little carefully. It's on the triumphal arch above the altar, and you will see on the left and on the right, you will see the Magi. But they're not wearing the simple tunics that they've worn in the 3rd and 4th century images. They wear these crazy, multicolored, exotic costumes that look like they have sequins on them, to show, again, that idea of the exotic magicians, these people from a faraway land, from different systems, these kings, this royalty, who once again bear homage to Christ. Then, walk into any art museum in the world, and you'll start to see the Magi represented in by the best painters that Italy produced, that France produced. You can see the Magi by Roger van der Weyden, by Hugo van der Goes. You can see the Magi by Gentile da Fabriano, by Mantegna. There are so many images, because this is a story that never, ever tires. And as of 2006, you can go to the movie theater, so you can go to your DVD rental store, and you can see the three Magi reinterpreted one more time in the movie The Nativity, where the Magi play a huge role, but they play the role of science here. They play the role of science recognizing the greatness of Jesus. The three Magi in the film are represented as a group of men who are surrounded by their instruments and their charts and their books and all the things that give proofs and indications. But when they realize that something extraordinary is happening, they have to get over their reluctance to leave the safety of their laboratory, to leave things in a theoretical, just understanding state, and to go out and to physically experience the arrival of this divine manifestation. And they have no doubt when they arrive, and the last thing they would expect, they arrive before a stable, and there, clearing away the sheep, there is a humble man and a humble woman and a child lying in a manger. And they don't hesitate, they don't look at each other with bewilderment, they bring their gifts to this child, because they see the divine.
Here in Italy, the Feast of the Epiphany was once the traditional day for gift giving, and still is, but under a different name.
Smart Italian children have figured out that you can manage both Christmas and the Epiphany. So over the years, a couple changes have been made. The Epiphany is celebrated in Italy primarily by calling the figure of the Befana, which of course is just a alteration of the word Epiphany, the Befana. And the Befana is a colorful folkloric character of a woman who lived near Jerusalem, or lived near Bethlehem to be precise, and she was a very house-proud woman. She was very interested in keeping her house nice and making sure the dust came out. And on the night that the three Magi passed by her house looking for this Christ child, she was too busy sweeping and cleaning and fixing her curtains to give time to the Magi, and she sent them on their way and told them not to let their camels track dirt on her her front yard. And so the Befana shortly afterwards realized her mistake. She underwent a conversion, if you will. And so she got on her broomstick and she flies around the world looking for the Christ child that she did not think about when the time was right. And she is the one who delivers gifts to children. She'll bring sweets to the sweet children, but she'll bring coal to the naughty children.
And how do the Italians celebrate this day? I mean, do kids wake up in the morning and find presents under the Christmas tree, which is still there? Or I know they have big festivals,
It's a funny adaptation of other Christmas traditions. It's a stocking that comes. And so the stocking, however, is filled with candy, generally, and a few little token pieces of sugar coal. But once again, it's a question of hanging stockings or putting out stockings the way that we would for St. Nick.
Mm-hmm. And are there any particular festivals going on in Italy?
Well, the Befana is the main star of the Piazza Navona market during the course of the entire Christmas season, basically from the beginning of December till the period after the Befana. You'll see dozens and hundreds, I should say, of the little puppet figures of the Befana. They do have festivals. In Italy, any occasion is a good one to get together and eat and celebrate, so there'll be some nominal Befana festivals. But mostly it's just another day to continue celebrating Christmas.
Have the Italians then lost sight of what the feast is really about the three Magi?
I am very much afraid so. I would like very much to say, oh, no, 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 it's still there somewhere. But I seem to remember a few years back, a television interviewer going around to the children in Piazza Navona who were, you know, picking out their stockings and looking at the Befana and asking them, well, what's this holiday about? Why do you have the day off? And they don't know. And so it's a little bit, it's more than a little bit, it's very tragic to see that something that is such a part of the character of Italy has been completely, the Christian base, the real reason for it, has been completely forgotten.
Yet, the three Magi have an important message for those who take the time to listen.
The three Magi, I think, for us today, again, represent that universality, that every single person is called to follow Christ, and that Christ's salvific sacrifice was for every single person. And I think, like the Magi, every single one of us from every single background can make the same example of bringing a gift to Christ. The question isn't, of course, whether we're bringing gold, frankincense, or myrrh, but that we can go back to thinking about how this is an occasion for us to remember that God showed himself to us and that we should show our homage as well.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University here in Rome. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.